So if you go in, Sergeant, if you care to go first, we appreciate your being here.
I'd like to do a quick introduction of who agreed to come to give us some stakeholder input tonight is Sergeant Brett Scott. He's a sergeant of the Highway Patrol. Their division begins in Aberdeen and then is doled out. I can't tell you how many divisions you have from Aberdeen, but Glacial Lakes, which is north of us, and then, of course, Watertown. How many squad areas are there out of Aberdeen?
Five,
okay. And Sergeant Scott's a sergeant here for our squad area here in Watertown. And we wanted his input on several things, but their office is in the basement of the Sheriff's Office Detention Center. And also he can bring a perspective of a regional detention center because they do patrol all of our surrounding counties around us. So with that, thanks for coming, Brett.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we're all ears right now. So.
Okay. Like Toby said, my name is Brett Scott. I've been a sergeant in the Watertown squad for off and on for about 7 years. I was gone for a little while, but came back. Our district is based out of Aberdeen, and we separate that up down into squad areas. My squad area covers four counties on a day-to-day basis, which is Dual County, Coddington County, Clark County, and Hamlin County. Within that, those four counties, I supervise seven troopers that patrol the roads of those four counties just on a day-to-day basis. That's generally where they work. Also within this area, there's another sergeant. His name is Steve Melland. He is a motor carrier sergeant. If you guys don't know what motor carrier, you're used to seeing us out there in the cars stopping speeders and that sort of thing out in the interstate. Motor carrier is the guys that enforce the truck laws in South Dakota, do the weighing of trucks, answer all those types of questions. We also do that, the seven guys and I do. But they're the experts at it. He also has two inspectors that live. One lives in Clear Lake, one lives here in Watertown. But those seven, my seven guys, the two inspectors, and Sergeant Melland, and I all work out of the Watertown squad office, which is in the basement of the sheriff's office. I do not know how long we have rented from the county. I believe, I've been on the patrol for 19 years, and I believe it's at least that long, if not longer.
Excuse me.
Grab the handles, sir. Apologize for being late.
You grab the handles, sir.
Generally, we do not have all 11 of us in the office at the same time. That is not, obviously, we work different shifts. My main job is in the office along with Sergeant Mellons. I am probably there 75% of the time. Within our office in the basement, if none of you have ever been there, we have an office for myself, an office for Sergeant Melland. We have a general squad area for the guys. We have about four desks in there where their computers can be put in and they can do their work in there. We also have a storage area for our files, all our supplies, all our other equipment. And then we have an evidence room in there as well where we keep all of our evidence that is seized. We do have squad meetings every month. So there's eight of us in there, if not more. Generally, you end up using the EOC conference room on the other side of the building to hold our meetings just because of the size of our group. That it just gives us a better open area to work and to have a meeting. The importance of us remaining in the sheriff's office, we do pay rent. I don't know if the state, the knowledge I have of how we do our rent, it is a limited. They only go up so far. You know, I don't know which one of you here has. I know Jim Sutton has showed me it several years ago. It's an increased amount for now up until we renew the contract. The state, of course, I don't have anything to do with negotiating of it, but that is it's probably not, for the size of footage, I'm guessing it's not a real moneymaker for the county. But the importance for us, in my opinion, is one of the things that people don't think of is we have visitors that come, not visitors, but people come to the sheriff's office looking for answers. Most of the foot traffic we have is due to motor carrier. It's commercial businesses, gentlemen or people driving commercial trucks that have questions about how much they can haul. What do they need? What kind of plates do they need to use on their vehicles? That sort of thing. They come to the treasurer's office. They don't necessarily have the answers, and they send them to us. So they come to the sheriff's office, and then they're sent down. It makes it a lot easier. We're right there next to the treasurer's office, or the treasurer's in the courthouse. They come in, they come down. If we weren't in the sheriff's office, we would more than likely be out. The state would have to do something else, and my guess is what we would do is end up out at the state shop in a separate building. We have some of those around the state. I've been in squad areas like that. This works out better. And that's just my opinion. I've been in a squad office out on a rest area south of Brookings. That's where I was a trooper. I've been in a squad office in Huron. This is more ideal for things like that. It is also better for when we obviously take people into the jail. In our area, with working Dual County, Hamlin County, Clark County, and Cottington County, generally all of our people we're taking in come here, which is much better than having to go. The only one we might not is Dual County will book their own people in if they have a deputy on duty when we're working. That doesn't, they usually do, but if it's anything out of the ordinary, we're still going to haul that prisoner up here anyways. Go ahead.
Does Dual County have cells?
No, they don't. It would be just simply a book them in and release them to a first offense DUI where somebody can come in, they can be signed out with them, and leave. Another advantage right now is with the change in the mandatory blood draw, we now request search warrants if somebody refuses to give a blood draw. Here, it makes it easy. We take them up to the jail. We have them sit in a holding cell. We go down to our office. We type up a search warrant, get a hold of the old on-call judge, and do that right there. It is much easier than sitting in our patrol car at some of these other stations around the state. They either have to sit in their patrol car or they sit with the prisoner in the back seat typing this up. We have an advantage here. You know, we don't have to drive across town. We just simply take them up there. We go down to our office. We complete that paperwork, go back up, get them, run them up to the hospital. And it makes it a lot more, it makes it better for the guys. It's safer for our guys to do it that way. And it's just a lot better than sitting in a car or having to drive across town and do it that way. Some of the other things that, I mean, like I said, I've worked in Huron. I've worked in Brookings. I've been up here. Before that, I worked at the South Dakota State Penitentiary for a little while. My main concern with the jail, current jail that we have, I call it we have it because I live here in Watertown, and it even bothers me when we take a prisoner up there, is where they book them in, it just is not a safe area. It is not safe for the jailers. It's not safe for the officers, especially during the day. Inmates that have been given duties and stuff and they're not in their cells, they can come up right behind you. I have never, ever been in another jail setting like that. And it's not anybody's fault. They're working with what they have. The control room, in my opinion, I'm not a jail expert, is probably not in the location it should be. At the time when the jail was made, that was probably how it should be done, but things have changed and they've discovered better ways to do this. The other benefit, obviously, is we're in close proximity to the sheriff's office with their deputies. We can share information easier. We can talk to them guys. Our relationships are better, which is always good. The other thing is on a Saturday or Sunday, I work every other weekend. I generally am in the office. Our guys spend time in the office and things like that. The deputies sometimes are out on the road and not necessarily in the office. Unfortunately, the jail, sometimes the staff will have problems with inmates, as much as we don't want them to, but inmates act up. That's what happens. If I call out, they hear on the radio where I'm at or where one of our officers at. If they have problems, and I am there, I will go up and assist them, or one of my officers will, which is a big benefit for them if their deputy is over in Henry or over in Florence and is 15 minutes away. Well, sometimes that's too long to wait, and their jailers may need help. So if we can do that, we're more than willing to help. And I wouldn't say it happens frequently, but I would say probably at least once a month or more, one of our guys or myself goes up to assist one of the jailers or a deputy with an issue they're having with inmate or inmates.
If I could ask a question.
Yes.
So does that, and this may be to both you and the sheriff, does that normally happen during the booking process when that gets difficult, or could it just be any time?
It could be any time. Okay. Could be any time. Could be a long-term inmate that were, you know, behavioral issues, potentially, or somebody that's just being brought in. So anytime.
Sorry to interrupt.
Nope, that's perfectly fine. I'd rather answer questions. I'm better at that. But that is one of the things that I guess maybe Toby would say is more of a benefit to him, but it is nice. It's nice for the jailers. It's nice for the deputies. If we're there, we're more willing to help. So,
Sergeant, as far as your space requirements, how are your facilities now? Do you have enough room as far as evidence storage for supplies, those types of things? Lacking square footage, what's your opinion on that?
It's adequate. I don't know the exact square footage. I'm guessing we're a little over 700 square feet.
I was going to guess about 600.
With the two offices for the two sergeants, the storage room, the evidence room. Our evidence room is small. Maybe it's because we have an active squad right now. Maybe that's why our evidence room is small. We need a little more room there, and the squad office, not the two offices for the sergeants, the squad office area for the guys could be a little bit bigger, so we would give them a desk. Each one would have a docking station for their computer, basically. That would be not necessarily a huge increase in space, but...
And when you talk about evidence room, I think just to bring it in perspective, I would describe your evidence room more like a closet.
Yes. Yep.
I wouldn't even necessarily consider it a room as I would just basically a small walk-in closet.
Are there any climate control issues? I'd imagine the basement might be some.
I don't control it, or I guess I'd say I do because I'm the main guy in the office there. It fluctuates a lot, I can say that much. It can be hot one day, and then it's cool the next. I don't know why that is. the only other problem is we've had the...
It's because it's a patched building. I mean, we deal with that on a regular basis. It's because it's a building that was patched onto an old building. And Johnson Controls is there. They really like us because they're there quite often. The climate control issues are...
And we still do have the sewer issues down there where usually it's caused by an inmate upstairs, but it'll cause backup like down in the main bathroom area where our guys use, where Jim and his and Marty uses. You know, it will back up the bathrooms right off our office.
When the new section was put on, it was tied into the old existing mains. There are two main sewer mains that are going out to the street, and when that addition was put on, there weren't additional sewer lines put in. Those two mains are still in.
And I don't know how many months ago. We did have a problem. I don't know what it was even. We didn't have it on the weekend, but we basically, the fumes were so strong, we left the office
Yeah, there was a portion of the afternoon where I had to evacuate my office because of we did bring redlingers in. They were able to find it. It was a sump. It was back up through a sump system in the basement somehow. I'm not a plumber, but I know they did find it and got that rectified.
For everybody's edification, so on evidence storage, each law enforcement body has their own evidence storage. Is there ever a case where it would be appropriate to share, or is that a chain of custody issue where you...
On our end, I can answer it. Generally, we store our own. There is Sturgis out in Meade County. The troopers do store their evidence with... The sheriff's office handles all the evidence for the Highway Patrol, and they will, I don't know of any others. Rapid City may.
What is your most common evidence thing you have? I mean, you have drugs?
Marijuana is the main.
Marijuana?
Yep.
What takes up the most space in evidence?
Marijuana. The other thing is we do, if we have a bad crash, every now and then we will have car parts in there, not very often. We've had some bumpers in there. We've, what we, kind of like an airplane black box where we can, where we do a download of a, basically a car's computer to figure out maybe some speeds or some braking distances and things like that. So we will have some of those things in evidence also. But yeah, majority is drugs. Our evidence room is probably 5 feet on each wall of basically like school lockers where each guy has their own locker, so it's separated so they, and they all have their own locks. So they, I'm the evidence manager, but they all, they can't get into each other's evidence. It's only, they're the only ones that they need something for court or to send into the state health lab, they go get it.
How long do they hold the evidence there?
Until the case has gone through the court system and there's been a result, and then we are able to destroy it. So we have stuff in there from when, most of you know Jim Sutton, when Jim Sutton was a sergeant, which was quite a while ago. So if there's still warrants out on the person, we keep the evidence.
So it happens when a trooper retires and the evidence is still there.
We keep it.
Is there a central location that they can move it to? We're, out here?
We are talking about doing some of that stuff with Aberdeen, about taking the retired stuff or when somebody leaves is, and there's still cases pending, taking it all up to Aberdeen and storing it there. But they also, they rent their space from the DOT, and they have limited space in the building they have to, so, but they're talking about adding on or doing something up there to help with that.
You had mentioned the squad office down at the rest stop by Brookings?
Yes.
Is that still operational?
No, when Brookings DOT built a new building, they built an area for the Highway Patrol up there.
And I think I remember when they started doing that, the purpose was to kind of eliminate some of the vandalism going on at the rest stops.
Yes, they basically put governor's offices up at the rest areas just to, for safety, and you know it was better to, they'd see the cars there and stuff, and
right.
Less vandalism and things like that.
But they don't use it anymore.
We do. We have one. It's not at a rest area. The Glacial Lake Squad, which is Sisseton, Milbank, they have a governor's house that's going in on the Department of Transportation site up in Sisseton, just off the interstate. Kadoka Squad office is out at a rest area. Chamberlain's is the old tourism building at the rest area down there. Vermillion's is it's not on the interstate, but it is a governor's home. And that, if we were not part of the sheriff's office, that's my guess is what the state would end up doing with us, because I don't think there's any more room out at the other building where the state rents so much from now.
So when you do the booking, you're separate from the jail? You do all the booking over there separate from your office?
Yes. When we bring somebody in, everything goes up to the jail. Everybody goes up to the jail there. So it's just like when we do warrants or we go down to our office. The other thing we use, we might take somebody out of the jail and use them when we're booking them, is if it's somebody under the influence of drugs, we have drug recognition experts. We'll take the inmate down to our office and we'll have an expert come in and basically diagnose them on what drugs they have been using and do a bunch of tests and stuff like that on them. But other than that,
per se, on a monthly basis, your squad, how many arrests are you doing? Any idea?
I would say this past weekend we were pushing 15 to 20, and that was for warrants, drugs, and alcohol, DUIs.
Just over the weekend?
Over the weekend. And is that normal? It's not during the winter necessarily. But it's sometimes it's less than, obviously.
Right.
But
those are actual arrests, people that are taken in and booked.
Taken in and booked, yes. That would be, yeah.
So it'd probably be a fair number to guess on the average, probably say 20 times a week. Per se average, you guys
pretty,
are coming to the jail.
I would say pretty close, yeah.
So where do you take them? And do they all come here, or do they go to Aberdeen?
We bring them all.
Your squad here.
My squad brings them all here, but that's the Dual County, the Hamlin County, Clark County, Coddington County, where my guys are working on a day-to-day basis. So that's generally, you know, we used to, our squad area until we changed it a couple years ago. I used to have Sisseton as well. I supervised the guys up by Sisseton, Millbank, in that area. We changed it due to simply because during bad winter, the road conditions on an I-29, it got to the point where it was hard for us. It was over a 100-mile stretch where my area covered. We didn't have enough manpower to cover to make sure everybody in their vehicles were safe if something happened. So we separated, put another supervisor up there, took a couple Webster troopers and made them part of that squad area, and we made it two so we could cover a little better. But we used to, I mean, we've worked up with the Roberts County when with their newer jail, so I've seen that jail. But.
So you're talking, you bring all your, from all the counties, you bring them all here for booking?
Yes.
So basically, it's a regional.
Yes.
Setup.
Yes. Yep. For us, it is.
Yeah.
Yep. I mean, majority of our arrests are in Coddington County, obviously, because the population base is here of our area where we work. But yes, we do take our Hamlin County and the Clark County and Dual County arrests up here. So
obviously, the process is it's up to the legislative body. But on your side, what are you hearing going into the future? Are they looking to expand your crew, troopers throughout the state? I mean,
they have been. Right now, we are allotted 175 uniform troopers across the state. So there's 175 of us. I don't know how many are supervisors, but we are, right now we're in the hiring process. We basically have 175 people right now. The state allows us to overhire due to projecting out retirements. You know, we can say, okay, we have this many people eligible to retire. They may not retire, but they're going to sooner or later. And usually every year we have an average of how many people may either leave or be let go due to whatever reason. So there's an average. So we're overhiring right now. So they could potentially say Watertown's a busy area or my squad is. Let's stick another guy there for now. You know, there is a need for more state troopers in the state. Most sheriffs would say that. We are undermanned as the state is growing. Up until a few years ago, we had about 160, and we hadn't grown in almost since the 70s. We hadn't added a person since the 70s out of our total number. So there is a need, especially Sioux Falls Rapid, to have an increase. But that takes, like you said, a legislative.
Right.
Yes, there is a
push. Is 7 the max right now? Are you full with all your positions here?
I am full right now. There is a chance that if we get enough people, when we hire on the basis of if we need 20, we may not hire. We hire the as good of applicants as we can get. So if we only find 10 guys we want or 10 people we want, that's how many we hire. So if we were able to get 15 people, I could potentially get an extra person. In my district, which is an Aberdeen squad, a Pierce squad, a Huron squad, Glacial Lakes, which is Lakeside Assistant, and Watertown. The activity is the Watertown squad and the Glacial Lakes squad. That is majority of the activity in our district is those two squads due to the interstate and just basically the amount of travel in this area compared to, you know, the other areas being a little more rural.
Sergeant Scott, can you comment on any comments on the courthouse, any observations about that? I would assume from time to time you have to appear, your troopers have to appear.
The troopers do. I, fortunately, do very little have to, which is good for me. It's nice for us to be right there. I guess we don't go to, we have court, we arrest quite a few people, we're not in court a ton. My guys aren't. It is overtime for the guys if it's a day off. It's definitely nice being right there for the guys. Most of the time they're reviewing a video right before they walk in. If we were out at the state shop, let's say, if that's where our office was, it's basically a half hour added or 15, 20 minutes to their overtime every single time because they're watching a video before they go into court because they want to make sure what their testimony is accurate. So that part is definitely a bonus. I mean, I watch the deputies of the jailers hauling their line of prisoners across the courthouse or through down by my office. It's probably not the best way, but that's what we have to do. So.
And then can you go back to the when you're talking about getting a warrant and you have to go to a judge, maybe I missed something there. Do you have to physically go talk to the judge or can you do that telephonically? Or?
We do it over the telephone and with computers. We're emailing it to them now.
Okay.
But the advantage to the trooper is by having it right in the same building is they have access to our office just to go downstairs, get on their computer and type up the warrant, make sure everything's
okay.
Right.
Okay.
And then we call the judge.
Okay.
And then he will email it back. It's signed. So we can do it that way instead of, like I said, having to go back across town if we weren't in the same building.
It's on a good meter program on an iPad for electronic signatures.
Yep.
And I've heard the troopers do this out on the highway with the accused in the back seat, and as soon as they hear a judge on the phone, they start wanting to talk to the judge or start yelling or creating a disturbance. So I've heard your examples firsthand at 3:30 in the morning.
Yes. Yeah, when we're doing our warrants, it's not usually during business hours.
Okay. So if I was just to summarize a little bit, and by all means, correct me if I'm wrong. Space-wise, it sounds like you have adequate space. It works the majority of the time. You could use a little bit more, but it's really not necessary at this point. Obviously, it's dependent on what you have, like evidence-wise and stuff. If you had to take a car into custody, you're not going to bring it down to your office. So, I mean, there's all these situations where you use stuff. Going into the future, as far as like what we're doing, looking at adding on or building a new facility, you probably need a little more space than what you have. It's a convenience thing to be located where you're at, but it's really about efficiency of your operation. If you were located somewhere else, time, which equals money, would be spent on going back and forth. And the biggest part of efficiency that really doesn't have a dollar figure is you talk about your working relationships with not only the other law enforcement officers, but the jail and stuff. You know, it really, as a county-wise, it's a huge savings for us knowing that you guys are allowed and do help out in the need of the jail. I mean, you couldn't even count the dollars we'd have to spend if you weren't there to call in a guy in overtime to help. I mean,
it's like I've said before, for us, we can't put a price tag on having a uniformed officer carrying a gun, even just in the parking lot of the courthouse, or going into the courthouse for court, or just being in the area. It's just that added layer of security that you really can't put a price tag on.
And we had, I don't know when it was, but Trooper Everhart one night, I brought a prisoner into the jail, booked him in, and had left. And the jail staff knew, I mean, obviously he was headed home or whatever, but he had just left. And I don't think it was his prisoner. I think it was, I don't know if it was somebody else that had looked in that night.
I think there was another inmate in the facility that started creating a disturbance.
Yes. And all of Sheriff Wishard's officers had gone, or deputies had gone home for the night. I mean, I think it was well after 3 o'clock. They got a hold of Clay or Trooper Eberhardt on the radio, and Clay went back and helped them take care of the situation. If they would have had to call somebody out, I don't know. I'm guessing it's time and a half or whatever pay it would be, and I don't know if they have a minimum time, I guess. But so it helped. We had a guy out. He can help take care of the problem. It's a benefit, you know, and like I said, it is a benefit because we get along very well. My officers and his officers get along well. We go to breaks on the weekends, which, is that a very big thing? Well, there's areas that doesn't happen, but it does help if, you know, we know when one of them's calling for help that, okay, because we know those guys. So it is a benefit. Like you said, you can't really put a dollar amount on that part of it or the interaction.
Well, and I mean, the efficiency part of it is we're saving taxpayer dollars a lot of the time, but it also makes the whole system work. Whereas if it's not working properly, you're literally wasting money trying to make it work. You know, I guess from my understanding, I know how it works with law enforcement, but maybe, I don't know if you want to touch on it, like every stop one of your officers make, if it's in the area, whether it be a deputy or a sheriff or a police officer from the city limits you, and you guys do this vice versa, every traffic stop, you always have a backup.
We don't.
Well.
Yeah, we don't.
If
I'm out on a traffic stop and one of the deputies are out on that road, they're stopping in behind me, or vice versa. Or we're just asking on the radio, do you want me to stop? Or we're checking on them. That's...
But that's my point of why I wanted you to mention it for some of the people that don't realize that, you know. You could see a police officer going down Highway 212 to stop a car. Let's just say, you know, for example, it's an Illinois plate. Within a couple of minutes, you'll see like a trooper come up and pull up beside or behind him. It's the natural backing up, making sure everything's 10-4, which a lot of times they're not 10-4. There might be a little scuttle going on. But once again, if you guys weren't doing that for them or they weren't doing that for you, it's huge dollars going, you know, the sheriff's going, well, I need 10 more guys on staff because I can't even back up my own people. And I mean, it multiplies.
And it is. I mean, one of the most dangerous things we respond to is domestics. And as a highway patrolman, we do not respond to a ton of them. Obviously, police departments and sheriff's offices respond to way more than we do. But we go assist the sheriff's office. If there's only one, like a Sunday night, there may be only one deputy out at a particular time. And that's the same way with us at times. We might only have one guy out at a specific time. So we'll go help. We're not experts at domestics. The deputy's probably going to have to handle the investigation, but just the danger of domestics and the volatile situations, you always want to go to those with two officers. You just don't go into those with one.
And then on the flip side, if we have a vehicular manslaughter or a bad traffic accident, a fatality or serious injury accident, then we turn that over to the highway patrol. They're the traffic experts. They can handle that. Save my deputies to be able to respond to the domestics or the burglaries or the crimes against persons that the highway patrol doesn't specialize in. So they have their specialty. We have ours. I still thank the Lord that you've got a full squad. Well, it's been 2 years now.
Yes.
Because prior to that, we were taking a lot of car near accidents. We were handling a lot of accidents. Now they've got a full squad, so that eases a little bit of pressure on my folks for traffic incidents.
I just have a question. How does you relate the size of the office to the incidents that you're dealing with? Like, really didn't talk about building size here or office space.
Our space, like, so we have 11 guys that work out of our office. The two motor carrier inspectors, they're not in there a whole lot. They have a van. It's in the parking lot every now and then up there. their sergeant is in there probably as much or more than I am, and then I'm in there majority of the time. The other seven guys, they do their paperwork down there, they get their supplies down there. We're not usually in there all at the same time. There is times we can be in there. Our general office, like for my office and Sergeant Mellon's office itself, those are adequate. Those are fine. The squad office area for the seven guys and the other two inspectors could be a little bigger. Our storage area is probably adequate. The evidence storage probably could be bigger because it does get full if we get some of those odd crashes or something that we have to take stuff in. But
where do you take, if you're investigating an accident or you have to do questioning, where do you take those folks to question? Do you bring them down to that space or?
Generally, no. I mean, we have, but
because of security, they obviously.
A lot of stuff we do is a lot of times on the road. Sure. When we interview, like a bad crash or stuff, we will bring people in if we've got video footage or something. We will talk to them down there. If it's a prisoner, a lot of times it's up in a holding cell. So.
Is there, I think I was thinking a similar question. You mentioned bringing people for a drug diagnosis down to your office area. Is that because of reluctant interviews, or is that in our jail? Kind of basically, is that basically the issue that we're talking about?
It's a better place because there's nothing else going on. If it's 3 o'clock in the morning, there's no other. There's not people coming in, being booked. You know, we're down in office. It's secluded.
Okay, so you pull away.
Quiet.
So. Okay.
You know, if we have a bad crash, or let's say if we make a huge drug seizure and we're going to seize the car, we take the car out to the state shop and store it. So that is one thing that we don't rely on the sheriff's office for. We would store that seized vehicle out at the sheriff's office or out at the Department of Transportation, out at one of their facilities. They do have some cold storage garages we can put it in if we have to keep it inside. We also have Andy Wicks from Performance Towing is more than, we'll go search cars in his garage and stuff. It would be, this is asking a lot. It would be, in a perfect world, if we had our own garage or garage space that we could search cars in, because we do bring cars in that, and we will go through them and pull parts off them and stuff like that. That's a wish list. You know what I mean? I mean,
well, it's realistic because that's an issue that we have currently too as well, is storing large evidence items, cars.
The Sally Port is not ideal for that.
That you have to take into custody. And that stuff could be shared if you had it,
yes.
But I don't have the space. You don't have the space, so we make do with what we have to.
The Sally Port
is less than ideal when you're dealing with evidentiary things to be at a local towing company, you know, utilizing their space because there just isn't any.
I had a question. Go back to you, Commissioner. We mentioned the Sally Port. Any other issues besides the fact that you can't? It's not really enough space to search a vehicle for any kind of vehicular stuff.
It's probably not quite big enough for modern vehicles, I guess. It's kind of tough to get in and out of with the parking lot right there. It could probably be bigger. It's if one car is in there, usually you don't. If another officer is bringing another booking, they usually just park right out in the open parking lot and walk the prisoner in.
How do you control tampering with the evidence, like the vehicle, if you just take it out to the DOT?
We don't really. We park it way in the back, or we park it in a cold storage building that we can lock, but it's not ours. Could a DOT guy get to it? Yeah. Usually if we put a vehicle out there, it's already been seized and it's our car at that point. We're just waiting for it to go put on the state auction or for that person to buy it back.
But the reason it goes there is they're state employees just like you are.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but I'm just saying, I don't keep it from being tampered with.
Yeah.
That's a valid issue.
What, okay, so you work for the state. Have you seen in other places, other agencies that could be, per se, if we have the space available by your office, that we're missing here in this area or for your squad? What I'm thinking is okay, so the DCI is a state organization. And they're partnered up with the Watertown Police Department in the Watertown Police Department's building. I guess as much as I know about it, I don't see that they would be better off if they were like in an office next to you. But is there other, I don't know, is there like a state ATF office that would benefit your area or your squad if we had that space available for them? Or?
As far as the state, I mean, as far as what we do, I don't think so. DCI, oddly enough, the PD and the sheriff's office probably works more with DCI than we do. We work with DCI very little unless it's a big drug case. Or a big drug seizure. So actually, detectives from the PD and the SO work with them more than we do, even though they're another state agency. But with the type of things they investigate, that they go more hand-in-hand with those two agencies than ours, actually. In Aberdeen, they do have driver's licensing in the same general building as the Highway Patrol. Driver's licensing actually has a ton of warrants. People come in to try to get a driver's license. They have a warrant out for them. One of our officers will just walk across the hall and go get the person. It's pretty easy, but I don't think driver's licensing is going to move from where they got. I don't know how that works. I know that that was part of the police department's plan when they built the new building, and driver's licensing would not go over there with them. So, but they're a totally different department than us.
Right.
So.
Any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much, Sergeant Stephens.
Thank you.
That was very helpful, very useful. We really appreciate your perspective on things. You know, a lot of it doesn't pertain specifically to the facilities, but understanding the context is very helpful. So I appreciate your time. And
thank you.
One more question.
What do you see in the big thing with the drug, big picture of the drug problem?
What's
growing?
This?
Is the drug problem growing?
What
do you see?
I've worked in Huron and Brookings and Watertown, and I like Watertown a lot. It might be because I have younger officers right now than when I first came here. My squad was older guys, and as we get older, we don't tend to maybe work the same as we did when you're younger and have that more aggressive as far as going out and finding. My squad is very active. I have a couple guys. We have one of our dog handlers lives. I don't supervise him. He's supervised by his sergeant out of Sioux Falls, but he lives in Clark. So he works this area. We make more drug arrests now than we ever have, you know, since I've been in Watertown. It might be because of the guys. I think it's a little bit of both.
Younger guys are more.
They're more active, yeah. But when I was, I don't want to compare us to Brookings because that's not really fair. I was fairly young when I was in Brookings, and we made a heck of a lot more drug arrests up here than we ever did in Brookings. And I'm not saying because we make plenty down there. It's the interstate kind of brings that. It's easy. I shouldn't say it's easy, but it is.
But Brookings has interstate right
away. Yeah. It's the proximity to Sisseton, to Minnesota. Those things all add up to you know.
Do they have a drug dog down at Brookings, or is that drug dog a major reason?
Drug dog obviously helps, but our drug dogs go all over the place. So he'll be in Sioux Falls one day and here the next. And we do not have one in Brookings. The sheriff's office has one in Brookings. So I don't know how active that gentleman is with his. We have a drug dog in Aberdeen. He'll come and work the Sisseton squad, more so than the Watertown squad, but he does work the Sisseton area quite a bit. So it's they're a very good tool for us. I've seen the jail in Huron, which is very regional because it's so far from kind of everything for being the eastern part of the state. And they will bring, you'll see, when I was there, Kingsbury County, which was, I suppose, 45 minutes away, was bringing prisoners. I believe Kingsbury County brings prisoners every now and then here.
Yeah, part-time bill.
So, it's, having the regional facilities is a huge bonus. It's a huge bonus for these other smaller counties in the area. It is. There's Day County. I'm amazed they still have a jail there. They probably shouldn't. They're not equipped to handle it. They don't have the staffing for it, probably, and I'm guessing it's...
I think it's about 16 cells.
Yeah.
That's something pretty small.
So it's definitely a benefit to the area.
Well, thank you, Sergeant Scott. Appreciate
you.
Your time. And we may be coming back to ask you more questions if we think of something. And as we get, we may have an architect on board maybe early next year, I'm kind of hoping so. He may have want to talk to you and the police about things. So
okay.
It. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, yeah. Is this specifically for the trooper before he goes? Or?
Yeah. If you don't mind. If not, I'll shut up. But it's nice to be able to ask somebody who's got the experience. You see the Watertown facility is kind of a regional facility. Do you have any input, because you've worked Brookings and these other places, why for some reason we seem to be jailing twice as many people per capita wise in Cotting County than in Brookings County? Do we have a bigger crime problem up here in your opinion, or whatever? You've got experience both. That's one of the questions I've got. Do we have bigger drug problem? I don't know.
It's a good question. I mean, I would say yes, there's a bigger drug issue in this area than there is around the Brookings and even Huron. We have a young squad in Huron, and they don't nearly make the... But part of that is the interstate for Huron.
But Brookings got the interstate. Brookings got the college.
And they have a college. Okay. No, that's fine. They have a college. I really don't necessarily know the answer to it as to why we're booking in so many more. It's this is funny because hobo days, or you have a college of 11, 12, I don't know how many
12,000.
Kids, and you'll drive around Brookings on a Friday night, and what do you see at 2 o'clock when bar closes? You'll see a lot of kids walking.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see that very much in Watertown. You just don't.
Good.
You know, yep. Young kids, they'll hoof it at 10 below.
Mm-hmm. Good
so,
point.
I appreciate your time, sir. That was very helpful.
Thank you.
Context. So, you can hang out and watch the rest of the proceedings. Or if you have,
I will
understand.
Head out. My wife is expecting me.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, next thing, that was very useful context, and so as we try to understand everything that might relate to the court of the jail. Last time we talked a little bit about mental health. Before that, we're talking about SB 70 and the incarceration alternatives, and kind of in that same line, we have Kyle Teen here from the Boys and Girls Club to tell us about the teen court and just kind of the idea with diversionary programs, and that it may have an effect on the jail populations, and it might relate to some of the things you're thinking about, Mr. Mack. So anyway. So I'll let Kyle take it away.
Okay, very good. Yes, my name is Kyle Teen. I've been with the Boys and Girls Club and the Teen Court program specifically for about 2 years. Right now I'm the Director of Club Services. So I've been associated with Teen Court for the last few years, but with our increase in caseload, we've also seen a reason to have more staff helping with our Teen Court diversion program. So basically the slides that we have for you guys are the exact slides that we show to our intake for our intakes for our families, for the youth that come through our program. So basically, what Teen Court is, it's a diversion program set up through the state's attorney's office where our youth are able to they're given an opportunity to take responsibility for things that they've done. Basically, we have trained volunteers where we have kids that come in and they serve as jury members. They also serve as our attorneys, and then also serve as a bailiff and things like that. So not only are we helping the kids that are getting things wrong, they're doing the wrong things, making poor choices, we're also helping the volunteers. At the Boys and Girls Club, we see a lot of at-risk or high-risk club members who could potentially fall into these harmful habits or negative behaviors. So by putting them into the courtroom, by helping them give diversion or set disposition for these kids, they're able to see, you know, the positive things that they're helping with as well. So if you want to, you can flip to the next slide.
So if you don't mind us interrupting you while you're playing.
You feel free to.
Say a team commits a crime, and they can basically, it's kind of like when, like for the People's Court, where they can sign away their right to due process and do this instead, essentially, in hopes of keeping them out of the court system. For
that's exactly right.
Okay.
Yep, and that's actually what I'm going to talk about right now. Nope, and that's okay. And basically the process, so if a young individual gets picked up for a crime, then the state's attorney's office then sends us the cases at the Boys and Girls Club, specifically to our teen court coordinators. Then what we do is we contact the families. We let them know that they've been given an alternative resolution for the case. Then the family contacts us, letting us know that they've received that, and we set up an intake session where we let them know what the teen court program is, what it's all about. And basically, after that, and then we set up a court night where we go to the Cuyahoga County Courthouse.
I was wondering, are these primarily misdemeanors then?
We see cases from underage consumption to petty theft. We've had a few,
They're not felonies.
Nothing like that. So, yeah, we see, and it's been increasing as well. I mean, we'll show the slide here in a little bit. Over the last few years, we had as few as 10 or 15 cases per year, and now we're up to like 66 cases year to date right now.
Is that because there's more of it happening, or
no? I would.
Using the system more?
I think they're using the system more right now in Cuyahoga County. We are the only court certified program for diversion, so we're the only place that the state's attorney's office is sending cases right now. So, and that could change.
First offense, second offense?
We try to stick to first offense, but we have received some second-time offenders. Second-time offenders are a little bit more difficult to handle just because they've already been through the process. Bringing them to the courtroom, they might not have the same effect. We do really like to have the first-time offenders because we see a lot better results, but that's all dependent on the state's attorney.
Are all based on what the state's attorney decides,
right? Yep. They'll send us a program request, so they have to definitely waive their right for the formal prosecution.
Still on this one?
Nope, you can go ahead and move to the next slide here. Inside the courtroom, like I said, we kind of hold it as a mock trial. We really give those defendants a real-life feel of what it's like to be held accountable for their actions. The jury members, they'll sit on the jury. They'll sit right in the jury box just as if there was a regular jury trial, and they're going to listen to the case. We give them a fair opportunity to share everything that they have. Because it is a mock trial, we have a prosecution and a defense attorney. And now the defense attorney isn't obviously there to defend the defendant, trying to prove their innocence by any means, but they're trying to point out the positive things that they're doing in their life so far. Maybe they're involved in extracurricular activities. We're really trying to build these kids up for that positive manner. Like I tell all the kids at the Boys and Girls Club and all the kids that come through the program, there's no such thing as a bad kid. There's only bad mistakes.
When you have the team, or I think a lot of those, I'm assuming they'd be going to school now, so is it evening or Saturdays or what?
Yep, and because it's juvenile, everything's confidential, so we have to hold everything after hours. The courthouse closes, so we start everything about 6 o'clock in the evening. So we're not actually in the courthouse for anything other than the court night itself. We handle all of our intake sessions. We also do like a probation check-in on a bi-monthly basis, and we do that at the Boys and Girls Club as well. So, but once they appear in court, the jury members have their opportunity to ask questions. We have a couple active attorneys in Watertown that come in and sit on as our judge, and they actually will kind of mediate the process. Also, the Watertown Police Department has come over to help us and sit in just as that officer in the room, which has been great, just to kind of really fill that atmosphere and fill that environment for the kids to feel to understand what's going on. After the jury has had their time to question, the attorneys have had their time to question, Then the jury goes back and they do their deliberation process, and they ultimately are the ones that decide the disposition. And I tell the defendants all the time, I tell them, I could easily set your disposition. That's not something that I know how to do. I can easily do that. I can set the community service. But it gives the jury members an opportunity to look at him and say, you know, I can tell that he's lying. You know, a kid can tell better than anybody else who's being truthful and who's being not. So these jury members, they stick it to them sometimes. We have a range of different punishments for them, and there are times that the jury members ask that we go above and beyond that or below that, dependent upon the crime.
And those jury members are volunteers?
Students? They're made up of both volunteers and also past defendants, because we actually do like a jury duty type where they have to come back and then serve on our jury as well. I really do think that's beneficial for them, because then they can see that, you know what, I'm clearly not the only one making mistakes here, that I can be a positive guiding help to other kids in our community as well. So.
And you have kids that volunteer to do that?
We have kids, and we have actually a lot of kids that they enjoy it. You know, they want to become attorneys. Or they want to become, right now, I started, like I said, 3 years ago, and we have the same bailiff and the same two attorneys for the last 3 years that have been a part of the program, who just, that's their desire, that's their passion. They want to become these things.
So. You actually use the existing courtrooms then?
That's exactly right, yep.
But it doesn't interfere at all with normal courtroom activities that you hear in the evening.
That's exactly right. Yep, and we'll schedule around if there's like a jury trial the next day, and they just say, "I'm sorry, we can't have you." We work around with the.
But you need primarily is office space and stuff like that, I'm assuming.
Well, yeah. I mean, we do everything out of the Boys and Girls Club right now.
Okay.
So, yeah.
What's a typical punishment?
I think it's coming up here as well. There's some slides that will talk about it. So here, right here, is our sentencing and our disposition. So what we ask that every single person goes through is we ask them to write a personal and a written apology. Okay, so a lot of times we have them simply apologize to their parents. You know, whether it's their parents are picking them up at 2 o'clock in the morning for an underage, you know, consumption, and they, you know, they just should face their parents and look them in the eyes and tell them they're sorry. We also have them write an apology letter if it's to a victim or to a, you know, Walmart or Shopko. We want them to hand deliver written letters to those people. Then we do ask, these are like our guidelines that we have here, between 2 to 6 teen court jury sessions where they have to come back and serve 6 times. Okay, and that's not just one case, that's 6 jury sessions itself. The next thing that we have is our community action points. Really trying to point out these positive things that these kids are doing. Community action points are positive community involvement. So if these kids are involved in debate, or if they're involved in extracurricular activities and sports and things like that, we want to encourage them to continue to do those things. During that initial intake session or during that check-in period that I have with the kids, I explain to them, if you go to your little sister's basketball game, that's awesome. Continue to go to those things. Continue to do those things. If they're involved in youth organizations outside of school or in youth groups or church groups, we definitely are always encouraging kids to do that. And those come in increments of 5. So that's why they're committed in those points. And then we have our community service, where they just have to go to different organizations throughout our community and serve that time. Restitution, if it's available. Going down to where am I's, the where am I forms are something that they would fill out for themselves and also their parents, to kind of have that accountability with their parents to make sure that they understand where they're at. And then they also get to bring those in so that we know who they're hanging out with and what they're up to. Okay. Dependent upon the class, we have them take, dependent upon the crime, I guess, is the class that they take. We partner with HSA for the alcohol and drug education class that they have there. And then we also have our YES class. That's a Smart Moves program, or a shoplifting program that we have at the Boys and Girls Club. In our Smart Moves, that's more for, you know, simple assault and cases like that, outside of drugs, alcohol, or shoplifting. So we'd go to our Smart Moves class. And then our jury members, if they feel that anything else, if they can ever add anything to that, they don't have to stick to those guidelines. If it's something that they want to go above and beyond, they can do that as well. And then finally, what we have them do is they have to participate in bi-monthly check-ins. where they meet one-on-one with one of our teen court coordinators and just simply have a conversation. Are they keeping up with their community service? Are they keeping up with their essays that they have to write so they can go forward and get it completed? Because they have 90 days to complete the program and program itself. And if they reoffend in those 90 days or if they were to not complete in 90 days, we send their case back to the state's attorney for formal prosecution. So, yep.
How many of them, percentage-wise, complete their citing in the scheduled 90 days?
Okay, we will be having that come up here in a short amount of time. I want to say it's 75% over the last 5 years that we've had complete successfully. And our recidivism rate is about 5%, and because we reevaluate after about 6 months. So we're seeing really great turnouts with the kids that are coming through our program. So I think, yeah, we can go ahead. And so upon completion, we do a six-month reevaluation to see where these kids are at. We have a good relationship with the Watertown School District where we're able to check in with them to make sure that these kids are attending class, that they're going and they're doing the things that they're doing. We also have a staff that are part of a committee at HSA that they sit down with the Department of Corrections, and we have an opportunity to see and make sure that these kids are on task, that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, they're going to the counseling sessions and things of that nature. So, and yep, go ahead. And here's kind of some information for you. Since 2013, our program's caseload has more than tripled, and the group has already been referred 66 cases. Now, not all of those cases have been sent to court, just due to the fact that, you know, maybe a family doesn't respond to that letter, or they just simply blow us off, or they just say, you know what, we don't want to participate in teen court, we'd just rather go through the juvenile system. But so far, we have 66 cases. This is an increase, and like I said, at one time we had only 11 cases that came through our door. But with a 75 successful completion rate, and then 5% of those kids have reoffended in 6 months. So. Yep. And then this kind of just highlights over the last few years where we're at. With 2011, we had 10 cases, and our gradual increase over the last few, 66 so far this year. So, and that on a weekly basis, we could receive 2 to 6 cases.
So only of those 129 teens, only 5 have reoffended after that 6 months.
Yep, that's right. So we would, of that, yeah.
5% of it.
Yeah. Well. And I want to say at a statewide, because we are a part of a South Dakota Teen Court Association, and state level, we're at about a 10% recidivism rate, so we're obviously under that, which is wonderful that we're actually making an impact on these kids' lives. So,
when we were talking before this, you mentioned how, what did SB 70 and SB 73, what do those things say about teen court?
So, programs? You know, a lot of it's coming that, you know, we're really shifting our focus from sending kids away or sending kids to, you know, juvenile detention or whichever. And I think it was, you know, and I probably don't know it as well as I should, but there's about $250,000 out there for teen court programs or diversion programs for the state to, you know, get more kids into. At one time, I believe it cost the state upwards of $155,000 per kid to go off and to receive juvenile attention, you know, and through the formal process. Our teen court program, what it costs us is simply to pay staff and to also, you know, it's $100 for the kid to take the classes or to come through the teen court program. And dependent upon the class, it's between $100 and $200 for that student to participate. So really, we're only looking at the time that we have with our kids and the $200 or $300 that will be going through for each one of our kids that are going through diversion.
And does anybody from the committee have any other questions? Well, I think that, one second, Mr. Wright, is the thing that I think is important about this is that, one, we need to know what the county is doing with the incarceration alternatives and alternatives to deal with, you know, the traffic that may someday end up in the jail, so in court. So that's, and so I appreciate you being here. And we have one question before we let you go.
Sure.
You said that you have attorneys that have volunteered to come in and be the judges, but you also referenced attorneys both as prosecutors and and defenders. Are these actual attorneys, or are these some of the kids' court individuals going and acting on their behalf?
That's right. So when I talk about active attorneys, they're going to serve as our judges. Okay, so they'll sit on the stand, and they will be kind of asking the questions if there's any extra questions that need to be asked. Okay, but then we have volunteer attorneys who are teenagers that will actually serve as our defense.
But they're not attorneys.
They're not attorneys, no.
Okay, that's the only clarification I wanted to make.
Yep.
Period. Thank you.
I do have a question for you. Sure. I know the answer, but I just want you to convey it. Infrastructure-wise, I know you folks have had a few instances during Keene Court where things have gotten a little bit emotional, mm-hmm. or you've had a parent that's gotten a little bit out of control. Security issues?
Yeah.
See that as an issue.
Yeah, and that's why we always really enjoy like having the Watertown Police Department come in and just to be there. You don't see it a lot where parents get upset or things like that, but I mean maybe it's just because of the officers in the room that they know that. We've had some times where we've had to, you know, ask the parent to step out to cool off, things of that nature, but nothing where an officer has had to step in just yet.
Are those parents sometimes maybe part of the problem in the first place?
Yeah, of course it is. You know, we have John Wiles, and he fills in quite a bit, and he firmly believes that, you know, it is the parents that he'll ask him, he'll say, you know, this happened on your watch. You know, what do you have to say about it? And it really kind of hits home sometimes with those parents that they unfortunately had a kid that stole something, or they had a kid that got caught with marijuana, you know, or things of that nature. So.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Kyle. Yeah, thank you for your time. I know you had to wait for your
No, that's okay.
You're welcome to stay, or you can go and eat dinner if you want. So, you're going to keep on going. So. Okay. All right. Moving on with the agenda. And by the way, just so you know, we may have more questions as time goes by, you know, especially as we want to understand it.
Sure. Yep. Sounds great. Yep.
Okay, so last time we had Mr. Garnos here, so we're on item 5 of the agenda. Last time we had Mr. Garnos here, and I hope you had a chance to take a look at this report. I didn't print it up because it was online, and we're in the digital age now, and it's over 100 pages. I got a few slides just to refresh your memory. So his contract essentially said this. Yeah, this is in your printout. These are the tasks he did, and the page numbers referenced that teach those tasks, except for number 6 when he was here at the last meeting giving his final presentation. So, and then I guess I'll just flip through these. These are some of the key points we did. We had him do the projections of inmates. We talked about how he dealt with the spike, and so I think we're all familiar with that. Just stop me if you have any questions. Okay. Then trying to forecast jail capacity requirements. There's another slide about this later on, but this is the one where it's just purely looking at the statistics without looking at some of the other context. We're going to look at the facility. So this is, you recall, this is the one where the last column on the right is his theoretical bed count based upon applying ACA, American Correctional Association standards, to the facility, and just looking at a pure floor space kind of, I guess, view of things. Am I understanding that correctly, Sheriff? I think.
Yes.
So, and then he came around 62 beds versus the 96 beds that are situated in there now. So that, and then other issues looking at the jail. This is cut and pasted right out of his report. I might have shortened a bullet there, one or two. So that, and then at the end, in the conclusion part, and as well in the beginning in the executive summary, excuse me, he gave a few recommendations. And if you take a look, pay attention to these, please, to make sure that we're getting what we expected. or I should say what's reasonable in our situation. And so that's a quick rundown. We can go back and forth through the slides, but does anybody have any discussion points or questions about his report? I hope you all had a chance to review it. I think most of it you'd seen over the course of several meetings, because a lot of it was the same graphs and slides that he'd been using throughout his visits. So, yes, one second, Mr. President. Just so the idea is, if we're willing to recommend this to the commissioners, then he's done with this set of tasks. So that doesn't mean we might go back and ask him or another consultant to help us with some other question as time goes by. But, Mr. President.
Well, what I was wondering is, what numbers are we going to be using? Because we don't know if this plate is here to stay or if it's going to drop back. So is he recommending 100?
This is his take at the point in time. Mm-hmm. Based upon, if you look at just the raw data, the top line of the slide says, he was thinking 100, 120.
Right.
Just looking at the data. But now we have a spike in the summer that kind of, threw a wrench in.
What I was wondering then is somebody going to be looking at the data as we go along next year?
He agreed to update. Okay. So the sheriff has provided him the October statistics. And so as we provide him stuff, he can easily update the graphs, right. And he's willing to do that. I specifically asked him that question, right. So he's willing to help us out with that.
You're way ahead of me.
Yeah. So. Just for the rest of the meeting, Mr. Manager, we'll wait till the open, okay? So.
These are just key recommendations, right?
Those are the ones that came out of him. If you're going to boil it down and look at the things he recommended, and that, here's the tricky part about a jail as opposed to, I think, the court, and it's a little bit easier because you're not dealing with the fine detail that a jail does. And so it gets a little trickier. So I think what he's basically telling us, and this is kind of what's kind of a little bit, we all hope for something really solid, but because of the spike and because things change, he's saying, make sure you look at this stuff.
But he's not saying whether we can use the existing building as an add-on or a brand new.
I think he does give us his recommendation. If you look at this one here, this is slide
to go over one page over overall issues with the jail, the last two.
Yeah, I think he's saying that that's his opinion. And so we're unable to meet the So that's his take on the facility. That's right out of the conclusion of the.
And I think that's an important soundbite that we need to make sure is pulled out of there.
Yep. And the slide, a couple slides before that, with the table of. Where is it?
Mention the fact that, okay, so his recommendations, he's saying that if looking at the situation and trying to spell it out for the next 20 years, mm-hmm. he's saying we need a different facility that is 120 to 140 beds.
Yeah, he's saying that's his take right now. That's kind of
that's a minimum. That's his minimal recommendation for us.
Yeah, here's what I would say to that. I think that's what he's saying is that at this point that's what he would recommend. That's how I understand it. But I think we do need to allow him to update those. To update the statistics as we get them in. So.
And we'll he's very interested in what we have going on as far as population.
Yeah, yeah.
And we'll continue to feed him as much information as he wants.
Yeah, I mean, he's willing to update the graphs.
Just
so you guys are aware, he's frequently hired by architects to continue on with this kind of work. So he could. Yeah,
so the one thing that I think is worthwhile mentioning in part of the board is to look at the stuff that's been done in the past.
Mm-hmm.
What our plan for the previous design jail was a pod of 150 beds.
Yeah.
Correct?
What about it?
Approximately. We hadn't gotten down to the point of being able to just really designate, but somewhere between 140 and 115 was going to be the final.
So my point is we had one pod, 140 to 150, which follows his recommendation.
Right.
And the idea was, going into the future, you have to have a design plan of what happens if you need to add on room for expansion. So the idea was we can do another pod duplicated of another 140 to 150.
Right.
So I think it's unique that, following his recommendations, what we had laid out as far as the jail plan fit.
The other thing, you mentioned something about previous studies and stuff. You probably went through a section of the report that went back through. It's a kind of a nice compendium, a nice summary of all the stuff that was done before, starting back in, I want to say 2006, when the sheriff's office did a study, and the citizens group did an informal paper. So, okay. Let's see. That's just the pure statistical bed count that he was thinking if you just go by raw statistics. And, yeah, two recommendations. So, if any other comments or questions about this study?
I would move to send that report to the county.
Okay, we have a motion from Ms. Grumman to send forward here a second. Send forward.
Second.
Okay, second. So, all right, any other points of discussion? Any other questions about this? Okay. So, if you're ready to vote, if you're in favor of sending this report forward to the commissioners, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Okay, motion carries. So I'll bring that to the commissioners probably the next commission meeting, and that way we've been paying, just in case you're wondering, we've been paying Mr. Garnos because it's a nice thing to do, and he said we would, and that is his final payment. We can do that too. So okay, next thing, criteria. This is agenda item 6. So this is just more discussion, but I think this is something we're probably going to need to take some kind of, you know, adopt this at some level, not necessarily the be all end all, but as a standing set of criteria. And we have a separate handout because it's a little easier to read on the slide. A couple things I would point out. I sent this out last night. I don't know if you had a chance to look at it, but I was, because of, I went to the Watertown charrette about the downtown planning, and it kind of brought to mind, I think you were there the first night on the Friday, but it was, I'm sure you had your people there, but it was a very interesting event, but just kind of brought to mind the desire in the community to have the courthouse stay downtown, and I think everybody wants it to do that, wants to keep as much function as possible downtown. So that's probably the key addition to this, is the number 10 criterion, number 10 for location.
I got a question on that. Okay, first of all, I don't mean to be nitpicky here. We're not looking at moving the courthouse.
I know.
So when people say they want to keep the courthouse, what are they talking about?
You have to ask them. But I think what the criterion, that's exactly kind of gets to your point, is that the rumors aren't helpful. Because before the vote, and you still hear them every once in a while, that people say, like, why are you going to get rid of the courthouse? You hear those kinds of those questions once in a while. And when we can point to the fact that we have a set of criteria, one that we want to, historical preservation criteria, that we want to keep, parts of the courthouse absolutely must do. And then we want to maintain the appearance if we have an option that incorporates the current courthouse. And then we want to maximize the county and the court functions that are down there insofar as possible. Now, that's insofar as possible. So I think when we, it means different things to different people, but what I basically understand when people talk to me is that, number one, they just like the courthouse. I just think that there's things that's going. Number two, there people, I don't think there's much data to on this, but people are convinced, and there's probably some truth to it, that having the courthouse downtown does help the local businesses. So people going in and out of there for their, you know, their county business helps a little bit. So I'm not sure it's the most, you know, money-making building in the state. Like, it's, if there's a little bit about that in the paper, I'm not sure about that. But, and I'm not saying the paper said that, you were just quoting somebody else. So, but, and nonetheless, people are convinced that there's some business benefit, and they just like the courthouse. I mean, that's kind of what I'm hearing.
So. Okay, but the interesting thing is just what you said. They don't want the courthouse to leave downtown. They like the courthouse being downtown. It helps the businesses and stuff, and they're taking care of their county businesses at the courthouse.
Right.
The whole situation we're dealing with is the problem with the space for courts.
Yeah. Yeah.
We don't have a problem with the county offices or where they're located or what they're doing. It's the court space and the court's needs. So I think the misconception is because it shares the word court.
I think you're right. They're talking
that's
about
all
the
it
physical
is
building, not
we're,
so much.
The well, courthouse, for the most part, is where people go to do their county businesses. And if we're analyzing the jail and the courts, and we build a building somewhere other than that, the courthouse is still going to be there.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, obviously. That's why. And I think that's, if you just let's take a look at the wording for number 10 there to see, does that capture that? I mean, the point here is that we want to demonstrate, I mean, this is obviously a community desire. So, and this is, rather than talking about a specific building, it's a lot better to talk about criteria, where we say the parameters of what we expect. And so, or what we expect and what we desire. So, so when you're looking at just this criteria, you would say the more business you can keep downtown, the better. Now, is that the most important criterion? No, it's not. It's not more important than the act, you know, the proper functioning of the courthouse. So if you can't expand the court space downtown enough to answer the needs that are in the other criteria, then I guess you have a problem. I mean, this criterion is not going to get, you know, it's not going to be maxed out, so to speak. So that's kind of the point of doing this, is to demonstrate that we want to pay attention to this, but at the same time, you know, it's got to have an appropriate priority vis-a-vis the other priorities.
One of the other priorities related to that location, then, being that the majority of the people, or a lot of the people, like to have it downtown, is when it comes to the vote of the people, are they going to vote against it because of the location, and that it doesn't pass if that's the case? But so that should have
Well, I think it demonstrates that we're taking that, and we're doing the best. I mean, by putting it as a kind of an official criterion, we're saying, okay, this is something we are considering. We're doing the best we can with this. But in the end, you know, other criteria have a must-do or a higher priority than this one does. It's not, you know, you got to have a properly functioning facility is the main thing. So that's kind of the point of that. So I think we're kind of, I think we're all kind of saying the same thing. Is that right? Okay. Any other points on this? Do you see any edits that should be made in this right now? And if something comes to mind, we're not taking action on it tonight, but if something comes to mind. Okay.
The construction costs that you have on there, of course, that's up to the architect or whoever you get, but that, to me, is pretty, we're looking at trying to get a facility that will be operational, functional, and space available, and pass
right. A
referendum.
Yeah, that's a very good question.
I guess what I was saying was, of course, the construction cost is what people are going to look at, but they're also going to look at location.
Yeah, I know, but okay, that's true. So let's think about this. I mean, we kind of have to balance this all out. This is where it gets kind of tricky. Is you know, if you say that Well, number one, I mean, do any other criteria come to mind other than these right now? These are the, I mean, they're meant to be kind of broad-based, but Mr. Boston, do you?
The one I come up on all the time is the burden of cost. Who's gonna shoulder the burden of cost?
How is it going to be paid for?
Yeah.
I agree. So we like it if other people pay for it, obviously. But we're working on that, and we're trying to make some headway with that in the legislature. I'm not sure what we're going to get done this session, but as far as like using sales tax versus property tax and things like that. But the goal of these criteria is to address, to be able to compare options. So I'm not sure that that's something that's going to affect the vote. But as far as being able to compare the different options that say an architect that we're going to ask an architect to address. I just realized I skipped over. Oh no, we're doing okay. That was on what I mean. As far as being able to compare the different options, is that a criteria that would help us compare the different options, or is that just more, that's something that we definitely want to try to do, is find better ways to pay for it. So the question is, any other? Did I answer your question, Mr. Wasler? Okay. Now, what about looking at the different priority? I mean, if you're trying to ask yourself, like going back to Mr. Koistin's question, what's more important, the operating cost or the construction cost? I mean, that's kind of what my thinking was. So, and we may have to refine the definition of operational cost. Is that like looking at a 20-year, say, trying to map it out, how much would it cost to run a building for 20 years? I mean, that's kind of the thing. So, if we think that they're equally important, then we probably need to talk about it.
One thing to those farm guys out there, if you can show them it's going to cost this much, over 20 years to run this thing, with a lot of upkeep, or if you can build a new one, it's going to cost the same. That kind of, they're going to kind of like that.
Okay. You're right, the operational cost is a huge part of it.
If you can show the operational costs are up here, and building a new one long term is going to be less per year. We see it with the tractor. If you keep running that old tractor, your operational costs get up here, and you're paying more for an old one than you are for a new one.
Yep.
So we can portray that somehow.
We can come to the public meeting. The one thing that got my attention, and the reason, when I was first thinking about this, before I started writing it down, I would have put construction costs as priority one. But I looked at some of the slides from the architect who helped out Minnehaha County. And when you started mapping out the 20-year operational cost of the different jail facility options that he came up with, they were usually at least as much as the construction cost. And so when you're looking at it, that's kind of what just got my attention. That's why I thought, okay, that's more important.
The feedback I've gotten from business people in the community is more so pay attention to the operational cost. That is key number one.
Okay.
So I think you're right on with the way you have it.
Okay, so, but that doesn't mean we're neglecting. Obviously, we can't neglect construction costs, obviously. What about the must-do criteria? Does that look like a reasonable thing to say we must do this? I'm saying the minimums are basically what the consultants told us. Realizing that Mr. Garnos is, there's a little bit of a window on his report. Commissioner McElhaney mentioned that you got to have an expansion. We talked about this a few sessions ago, that at least it's got to have some kind of strategy for physical expansion, not just incarceration alternatives, but a plan to physically expand something if you got to do it. And that the idea behind that is that it's going to be easier for future generations should they have to do it, so they don't have to go right through the level of pain that we're going through now. And then the historical one, we all want to, everybody wants to keep the courthouse. They want to keep the basic look of it. So that's what number eight is about. So, has it got to do it? Okay. So, I guess we can leave it at that. Anybody have any other comments on anything? So, but I think if you don't, and my thought, and just please speak up, is that we should maybe just at the next session we can recommend that the commissioners adopt this as kind of a standing criteria. We're probably going to change it over time. You know, say the architect brings some things to our attention. We might want to put some more detail in a couple of these. They may have a whole list of a whole version of the detail kind of thing. So if there's any no other comment on this, we'll move on to the next part of the agenda. Just a question.
I think you did a nice job on putting that together.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Yeah. I'm touched. Okay. Thanks. Okay, so if you think of something, please contact me, and we can tweak it between now and the next meeting. Otherwise, I'll keep thinking about it. I might have some other things that come to mind. So okay, let's get to the last big thing, is the RFP. So okay, I hope you had a chance to read through the RFP. And just to let you know, a couple of the things that I guess I should highlight. Number one, the basic tasks at the top, that's probably the key thing. We can't remember if the last version had the site evaluation point, but it's the third bullet down, site evaluation of up to 5 potential construction remodel sites. So we hear different ideas. It may be a good idea to look at, well, what if we do this, what if we do that, what if we go out here, what if we go over there. And it would definitely be nice to have an architect's opinion to tell us what's reasonable. The other thing to keep in mind, and the reason that I spent some time on this RFP, is that if toward the bottom of the first page there, if we get funding for a facility, and if things are going well, we're pleased with this architect. The way this RFP is written, we'd be able to continue using that architect. And that's the nice thing about competing it now, that's a bit of a pain to compete it now. We can say that we've done our due diligence in finding a good architect. So, and I think the only other thing is if people are pleased with this, we'll obviously update some of the links, the references for people to use. As they put together proposals, so reference documents off our website. And then the last page I want to highlight is that where it talks about selection criteria. There actually is, I spoke to the state engineer office, I don't think it was the state engineer himself, but it's the office there. There's actually some laws governing how you bid out construction contracts. Well, it doesn't really apply to us because we're just dealing with architectural services. However, the spirit of those criteria are very useful in making sure that we got the things covered. And basically, it comes down to, do they understand their situation well? Do they have the experience, qualifications, the right people? And then take a look at what the estimated price would be. So, any questions or comments about the RFP?
How is it circulated? How do we get people to...
Oh, I'm going to ask the auditor how you do that.
Okay.
So, she'll know why.
So we're getting in the hands of the right people.
Yeah. And there's a couple architects that have been in contact. They watch what's going on. And so one of them provided some helpful... He gave me an RFQ, a request for qualifications. I used some of the stuff out of that. What was helpful with that was the actual format of the submission, which will make it easier for us if it's all in the same format. But then I want proposals, not just a request for qualifications, so I adapted it. And then Minnehaha's RFP was much shorter, and that was very useful. And then I went to the state engineer and said, what do you recommend? And then, had the state's attorney take a look at especially the tail end of this.
What about asking, like, Bill Garnos to go over that list of folks that we're sending it out to, of people that maybe he has
experience with.
And maybe our court facility consultant too, just so we're getting it into the hands of the right folks.
It's definitely good to cast a wide net. So, yeah. And then some of you have probably done the same thing. I've been researching this a lot. And so I kind of know a lot of, I know the needs of a lot of architects that that might be interested in this part of the country. So, and some, like I said, some of them they've already been asking me that. I think they've contacted other commissioners as well, saying, when are you going to issue an RFP? So, okay. So, would be nice if everybody's fine with this, is that we forward this to the commissioners, recommend this as RFP. They could probably still tweak a few admin things.
Can you tell me in there specifically where it's at, what they're supposed to be doing if you hire an architect?
Okay, that's...
I mean, they're going to be looking at constructing a new building or adding on or...
Yeah, the first step is that here's...
I'm just pointing reference into page one.
It's good to make sure we understand what we're talking about. So the options can encompass what's called a green site, other than that, or a green field site, where you have a totally like what we tried to do at the November vote, a completely new facility, everything's new. Or a remodel of something existing. So, and that's part of the reason for the site evaluation, so we can look at different facilities around town that might be worth, might be worth considering for a remodel or an addition that could be incorporated somehow. The master.
Can I interrupt you for just a second? If we're giving them the option of, and if I'm off base here, if we're giving them the option of bidding a remodel or a reconstruction, right, as one of their points, aren't we going against one of our, in Mr. Garnos's report, it says unable to be renovated or expanded in a way to address current deficiencies.
Mostly what that is aimed at, most of us kind of realize that about the jail.
Right.
So the criteria don't address remodeling, keep preserving the jail. The criteria address preserving the courthouse. Because that's a historic building, so that's
off and including that. Do you think that needs to be included?
You can't do the jail.
Right. Well, if you have somebody that's going to come in and say, "Well, okay, we're just going to remodel all of these things,"
I don't know if I want to be super specific. We could be, but they should. That's the reason why we reference them to the studies that are in there. It's all the work that we've done so far. So. The idea is that we want if they see something that we're not thinking of, we want them to tell us. I can't imagine that an experienced architect who does jails, modern jails, is going to say, fine, when they look at our jail after all we've heard. It's hard for me to imagine that.
I would hope not.
Yeah.
Are you getting two separate architects and one from courthouse?
Here's what we're asking for. That's a good question. And this is what happened to me. We're asking for separate proposals to do the whole thing. So each proposal should address the whole problem, okay? Both jail and court. So we don't want to be working with separate, we want
one architect.
Yeah. Now, it's possible that an architect, if they're smart, they're going to reach out for, they're going to subcontract some expertise for whatever, whatever it's not there for. So a good jail architect might not do courthouses all the time. So they might ask a local architect or a Sioux Falls architect or something like that. So
if they're smart, they would. The last architect, he didn't know.
We didn't do an RFP for that either. And that was a different animal. And that's something that we as a county are learning as we go through this. But that's part of the reason. If you look at requirements for the proposals, if you just take a look at that, there's a lot of information that we're asking for, some pretty specific stuff, but we want to be able to take the eyeball of the different architects and then look at their project history. If you look at section 8 of that, we're asking for specific experience about jails and courthouses. So that's part of what we expect from the proposal. So if we get an architect who, you know, designed a linear jail, I mean, that's going to be, if we actually decide to interview somebody who did that, then we're going to ask them, why did you do that? So,
I guess being with you and Tyler on the commission, you would be alert to that.
Well, we're going to, I mean, this is still going to be, the way this reads, I mean, this is designed to make the architect work with us and with the commissioners, and that's the idea. So one nice thing, if you get the right kind of architect that's experienced with this kind of facility, they can help you, you know, put more detail on the criteria or make sure we're asking ourselves all the right questions. And I think, you know, we're learning a lot as we go through this, so we're asking some of that, but there's no doubt some details that we're, you know, we just don't have the experience to hit upon. So that's why the proposal contents are so important, so that we make sure that we hit those things. So
I guess, and I don't want to get specific, but, you know, if they don't take the time to look around, or if one of them does, and like you've heard people say, you've been in the building.
Yeah.
Whether that's been enough to hold the auditor's office and all of them or not, I don't know, but we can go and find out. But I guess what I would kind of think that we should do is find that out if it is big enough. Mm. If it is, then make that part of what they should actually look at.
That's specifically, if you look at bullet number 3 on the front page, that's exactly what that's aimed at. Now, I don't really want to tie where it's a site evaluation of up to 5 potential construction remodel sites. So I don't really want to say, look at, in the RFP, I don't want to say, well, look at the Midland building with this, look at that. Because some of the things we might learn some things as we keep on having our discussions while this process is going on. But we do want to see, you know, we want to get an idea of how much that would add to the cost of the RFP. So we want to make sure we're up front that we're going to expect them to look at some.
Well, if they're going to look at 5 sites, I think that would cost more than looking at one.
Yeah,
but you could have different sites or the one. I mean, everything costs money. I mean, we've got our consultants for that too.
I hear about the Midland building. I've had somebody approach me about that.
Where do you start and stop?
The thing is, that's why it says up to 5.
But if you start naming specific buildings within the RFP, there's no way that you can.
Well, I think what I would rather have happen, I think, is to bring in somebody who's an expert to facilitate us to get to those points where we're asking for an evaluation of a logical site. That's why it's a little bit open ended. I mean, that's my thinking, and that's. Yeah.
See, what other buildings are they thinking about?
There's probably the other one that comes to mind is the old right across from the jail, the switching ones.
The auditorium?
Yeah.
To the south of the old Midland building.
So I think, Al, you would be surprised how many buildings would become up for sale in a hurry if they knew the county was
out looking. They had the square footage.
You'd be surprised how many people all of a sudden would have property.
I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No.
But the Quest building, for instance, we actually looked at that before, and the answer was you can stop looking at it.
Right.
Their hub, their operations, their battery systems, it's not even a valid option to say, what about that building? It is not. They have said the whole infrastructure of their system is that building.
Okay. Well, that's what I said. We should maybe kind of limit it a little bit because we already know that one.
I guess my question is, how do you limit it without writing down addresses?
Well, you can specifically say one or two buildings that you should look at or any other ones that they might deem.
Okay, well, that's kind of what I think this is kind of open-ended enough to say that. I mean, we're saying when you say site, we're talking about remodel, so maybe just say the Midland building, for example, or the current courthouse.
See, the thing about the Midland building, that's the steel frame. there's no supporting walls in it.
Okay, well, what then?
Then it can be remodeled.
Then we have the word of an architect, and off we go. And some of this can be pretty quick, and probably, or a greenfield site, or a completely new site. So, you know, those are things that, I think it's. I don't know, maybe
I would say this. Maybe the county would ask them, the commissioners would ask them to specifically look at that building.
Yeah.
Not as a jail, not as a courthouse, you know, for offices to move everybody out of
that's the intent of that bullet, is that task is to be able to do, to have the flexibility to look at different things and, you know, different options that might come up. So, you know, like...
Well, if you guys can mention it to them, because otherwise they're coming in from out of town, they don't really know what's...
Oh, we will. I mean, that's the point. So if you read through it, read through the RFP, you know, the idea is that they sit down and they talk to us. Mm-hmm. And they work through our issues with us. And so we start talking about and identifying different things around town. And I think that's a little bit similar to what was done with the previous architect.
The last part of the harm is that building is mentioned. And,
okay.
You know, you guys.
Yeah. But I appreciate your concern, because I've been asked about the Midland building as well. So it'd be nice to have a definitive answer to say yay, nay, you know. And I think it's also going to relate to. That's going to relate to a greater option about what happens. So if we start dealing with the courthouse, you know, something downtown, then
it's right downtown.
Yeah. So does that? I mean, is the wording okay? I think the way we got it.
That's fine.
Okay. All right. Any other comments on the wording? We're going to do under 2 hours. Go fast. Any other comments on the wording in the RFP? So would be, you know, I have to talk about this with commissioners as well. But
do you want a motion, Lee, to move
that? That's a little motion.
I would move that.
So the motion is for this RFP, recommend this RFP to the
commission. Yep.
Okay, do I have a second on that?
I'll second.
Okay, thank you, Chair Fisher. Okay, so we have a motion and a second. Any other discussion? Okay, so hearing none, if you're in favor to forward this RFP to commissioners, recommending that they use it to hire an architect for redesign services, please signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Say no. Okay, motion carried. All right, next item on the agenda is... just really quick here. This is the list of us. It's kind of the stuff that we need to make sure we're talking about. I'm thinking we can probably dispose of some of these things quickly in the next meeting in December, and then at the end of it we can either tweak the criteria or go ahead and adopt them as kind of the standing criteria is what I was thinking. So let's see. One note. A couple things. Okay, the longevity bullet there, the second bullet under self-analysis. I don't know if it would really help. Something to think about, for example. I mean, how many years beyond the 20 years of the projections do we want the thing to last? Those kinds of things. Or maybe we don't need to talk about that in a lot of detail. We already mentioned adding location to the list of criteria, and then for everybody's information on the at the bottom there under facility options, law library. Megan's help, we got a survey out of, got a few responses from local lawyers so far, just to see, you know, what do they think about having a digital law library, and how are they getting by without one right now. And so. That's ongoing, so hopefully I'll have the results of that next time. So any other, and this could, what I'm thinking is this is probably the last agenda of the year next time, more or less. Okay. All right. Are we still okay for December 15th? Is that still okay for everybody?
I'd actually like to make a suggestion that we just take the month of December off. I think a break would be well deserved.
So you're telling me you don't want to spend 2 hours in the movie? Okay.
December's terribly hard.
I don't take
schedule.
It personally. Oh, yeah. You personally don't fit into my Christmas plans.
Okay. All right. Is everybody okay with that? I mean, I think we'll be okay. I mean,
not to meet
in December.
Are you sure?
I'll miss you guys.
Okay. Just
have a Christmas party.
Christmas party?
Yeah.
Okay, if you want to have a party instead of a meeting, I'm all.
No, that's fine.
Okay, so we can still. I mean, do we want to find a party subcommittee? Okay. All right.
January, when do we meet in January?
Big party?
When do we meet in January?
I put January 19th. I was glancing at a calendar, but that's just my idea. I mean, is that January 19th look okay?
That's a Tuesday.
I believe it is. Tuesdays are still the.
Yeah, it's the third Tuesday of the month.
And Tuesday is still the best for everybody?
It's good to stay right.
Very good. Okay, so what we'll do is everybody okay with not meeting in December? For sure. Okay, I think here's the one thing.
I need to give you a break for your wife.
Okay. The one thing I'm mildly concerned about is the criteria. I think we're okay. I mean, what I want to do is make sure that is more or less firmed up as best we can get it before an architect is on board. So I don't think we need to. We didn't put it on the agenda to take action on it today, so we probably shouldn't. But if one thing I can say to the commissioners is that we basically sorted out, and for now it looks good. Moving on, it looks good. So by consent, anyway. Okay. All right. So next meeting will be January 19th. Enjoy your break. Your holiday. So any other unfinished business? Open stuff, new business or open any other comments? So now I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
Second.
Yeah, motion in a second. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. We're adjourned. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.